When you join a team, you agree to certain rules, certain common values, and often, you know, a single all-important goal. And so when a member of that team falls short, maybe the most meaningful form of justice is the kind that's meted out by your teammates. So I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is Sound Effect on KPLU. We're talking about teamwork today, and I'm here at Safeco Field, just above the field, and I'm here to talk about a unique way that Major League Baseball teams have figured out how to police themselves. And so joining me here is a member of the Mariners Hall of Fame, Jay Buhner. Hey, Jay.
How are you?
Jay, what is Kangaroo Court?
So Kangaroo Court consists of, it can be either, you know, a couple of judges, three judges, five, and it's usually the veteran guys. It's basically our way of when a guy messes up or doesn't run a ball out or does something stupid, you come before the court and all your teammates and you plead your case. And if you lose your case, you pay double. So the chances of you winning are pretty slim and none, although there are guys that put together a pretty good case and with pictures and
all. Oh, wow. So people bring forensic evidence.
Oh, yeah. They bring. Yeah. And then they have eyewitnesses and they'll basically do all sorts of crazy stuff. But usually the gavel drops and they're guilty and they pay double. And then what we do is we take that money and usually we donate it to a various charity or charities. And then the other part, we throw a team party a couple times during the year. And then the third thing that we could also use it is if something were to happen throughout the course of the season and we get in a beanball war or somebody gets fined or whatever it is, sometimes we use that money to basically help pay off that fine. So, it can be used in various different ways. Usually it's a charity.
So, wait a minute. Sometimes when people get fined for real by, like, the authorities,
absolutely,
then you can use the fines that are generated by the Kangaroo Court to
absolutely
offset that guy's fine.
Absolutely. That's what we try to do. We try to spread the wealth as best we can.
Who's the judge?
It's a veteran. It's been Chris Bozzio. Then when Chris moved on, it was myself. And then it was Jamie Moyer. And so usually it's a guy that has a little bit of tenor and some stripes on their arm. And every year it kind of fluctuates. Although, you know, every team doesn't do it.
Can you think of a particularly memorable infraction that wound up getting fined?
There's all sorts of various things that are going on. I mean, we fined Lou Piniella one time and Kangaroo Court because after a game in Boston, he decided that he was going to try to not punch the lights out going down the hallway, but try to kick them, and ended up on his back. And basically the next day was on the training room table and took away one of the training room tables because it's such a small clubhouse, couldn't manage that day. And so he got fined $100 for that.
Why is it important for the team to mete out justice to itself? Why is it important for those things to come from your teammates, not from the coaching staff, not right from Major League Baseball, from you guys?
At the end of the day, I mean, you know, it's your peers. You play hard for one another. It's a team. It's the best thing in the world for morale. Some guys get a little upset about it from time to time. But really, at the end of the day, it's respecting the game. It's respecting the uniform. It's respecting the name on the back. And even though it's a lot of it's in fun, at the same time, too, it is a little bit of a wake-up call and a little bit of a message.
Well, a guy that knows a thing or two about teamwork, Jay Buhner, Mariners Hall of Famer. Thanks so much, man.
Okay, my pleasure. Take care.
Well, teamwork is the name of the game here on Sound Effect from KPLU. We have tales of teamwork from around the region. That's just ahead, so don't go away. Okay, so I want you to imagine now for a second that you are a dog musher. In front of you, harnessed to your sled that you're standing on, is a team of 10 or 12 or 14 dogs in pairs. And you are barreling down a snowy, icy white trail in Alaska. And specifically, you are at a place on the trail called the Happy River Steps. This is a series of steep drops and curves coming out of the Alaska mountain range. Imagine watching your team ahead of you as you go around this curve. Your first two dogs disappear around the curve. And then the next two dogs disappear. And the next two dogs disappear. And the ones after that. And it looks almost like they're dropping off a cliff right in front of you. You can't really see what's beyond. All you can see is the big old tree that you might crash into on the left and the big old tree that you might crash into on the right. But don't worry, that outside tree is the one that's going to keep you from tumbling off the cliff to your certain death. So this harrowing experience is just one little part of the Iditarod Trail sled dog race, which is over 1,100 miles through some of the wildest parts of Alaska. There is a dog musher based in Bend, Oregon, named Rachel Sidoris, and she entered the race four times. She completed it twice, all at a pretty young age. And she did it in kind of a unique way, because the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race is normally one that you would run alone. This is like one of these classic tests of self-reliance. But Rachel ran it as part of a team. And the reason she did that is because she's no ordinary racer. Rachel Sidoris is legally blind. So think for a second about that scene I was describing earlier, how that might look through her eyes.
If I go down during the day, I pretty much just have to feel it. And if there is an obstacle, I won't see that until it's right there.
Part of the mythology of the Iditarod Trail sled dog race is that it's like one person against nature. And you went into it as a member of a team. How easy Correct. Or hard was it to get everybody on board with that?
Well, what I was originally asking for was a person on a snow machine to tell me which way to go, which is how I had been running stage races for years. And people were very against that because of the rule against outside assistance, which is understandable. But then when we agreed to do two dog teams, there wasn't much resistance to that. People were generally not opposed.
How did you find your first trail partner that first year you ran the race?
The first year I ran the race in 2005, I ran with Paul Ellering. We had raced against each other in the Bear Grease in Minnesota the year before.
Paul was a bit of an unusual dude. Can you explain a little bit about who he was?
Paul, in another life, was a WWE wrestler. He was known as Precious Paul. He was the chairman of the Legion of Doom. And he retired from that and moved on to dog mushing.
So what was your relationship like with Paul?
It was a friendly business relationship.
So friendly, but somewhat businesslike. And then how would you compare that with your next partner, who is a guy named Tim Osmar, who's part of a pretty well-known mushing dynasty in Alaska?
Tim's father, Dean, had won the Iditarod in 1984. Tim was a perennial top 10 finisher. His oldest daughter had won the Junior Iditarod. He'd won the Junior Iditarod three times a very long time ago. Everybody loves him, and he loves everybody. And everything was just easy. He never got worked up. His idea of getting really worked up is saying, "Oh man, I'm freaking out. I'm okay."
What's it like, Rachel, to have to trust somebody like that to help be your eyes? You know, that's a dangerous scenario. You're going at high speeds through really rough and remote and extreme terrain. And you really have to depend on somebody to kind of keep you on track. What's that like to hand that off to somebody?
Well, you know, I've always had to sort of rely on other people to know where I'm going and to not walk into things. I had never done it to the extent of the Iditarod before, but just getting around, I always had to rely on other people. So this time we were just doing it by dog team.
So having had lots of, let's call them teammates over the years in various parts of your life, people who have helped guide you and, you know, keep you pointing in the right direction, how do you know when you've got a good one?
I know I have a good partner when they look at it as a partnership and not like they're taking pity on the poor little blind girl.
You've alluded to this, but you've had to rely on partners and teammates your whole life for different stuff.
Yes.
But you strike me as a pretty independent person. Like, do you have, is this just a fact of life? The idea that you have to kind of depend on other people to help augment your own senses? Or is it something that, like, I don't know, is kind of annoying sometimes? Like, would you rather just be riding solo?
Yes to both. It is a fact of life. And sometimes I am at their mercy. So yes, there's always that thought in the back of my mind, like, wouldn't it be nice if I could just do this on my own? But I can't, so it's a very fleeting thought.
When you were preparing to enter the race for the first time, you want to talk a little bit about what you were up against in terms of, I don't know, attitudes, prejudices, maybe, things like that?
Well, sure. I think I've spoken to a lot of my detractors since that time. And first, the perception was that I was a totally blind person wanting to run the Iditarod. And I don't want to say a totally blind person couldn't do it, but it would be quite difficult, and I'm glad I'm not totally blind. So there was that. And it was really just that people didn't know what my abilities were. And I just had a little extra to prove. Everyone has to qualify for the Iditarod, but I certainly was under extra scrutiny, which I expected, which is fine, because most of the concern was for the safety of my dogs, which is fair. A lot of people said they were concerned for my safety too, but my response was, hey, I'm an adult. I know the risk I'm taking. I'm okay with it. I respect the concern for the dogs, but let me make my own choices for my personal safety. Thank you. And it was funny because a lot of people in checkpoints were coming up to me saying, you know, a lot of people thought for sure you were going to break your neck on that second day. I was one of them, but you made it. So good job. And I was like, well, thank you. Major question mark behind that. Thank you. I remember reading a couple editorials about I'm paraphrasing, but the blind Barbie from Oregon bringing up all the media. And I was reading those going, you are the media. If you don't want me to get attention, stop writing about me.
Does your ability to work with other people in this collaborative way carry over into other parts of your life, like your personal life? I mean, I know that you had a baby not too long ago, and parenthood is kind of the ultimate team sport.
Yes.
And I was just curious if you feel like you carry any of the insights into what it takes to have a good team and a good partnership into something like parenthood.
Well, I think so. I think, you know, whatever we accomplish, and this can be said for anybody, no matter how much we say we don't do it on our own. And all the sports that I've done have really pounded that into my head. Everything I've done, I have not accomplished by myself. And so, yeah, I do carry that with me. When we're up on the mountain on Mount Bachelor giving sled dog rides, which I am right now, by the way, my dad's up here with me. We have a junior musher up here, and we rely on the Mount Bachelor staff to help get people down here. And in the winter, we have a whole crew that runs our tours, and I couldn't do any of it without them. And so everything is teamwork.
Well, Rachel Sidoris is a dog musher and a competitive tandem cyclist out of Bend, Oregon. She was the first legally blind racer to complete the Iditarod Trail sled dog race. That was in 2006, and then she did it again in 2009, all with the help of a teammate. Hey, Rachel, thank you so much for being on Sound Effect.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and we're talking about teamwork today. And for this next story, we are welcoming the newest member of our team, our intern, Bree Ripley. Hey, Ripley.
Hello, Gabriel. It's nice to be here.
I am really glad to have you here, too, and especially because this story sounds really fascinating. It seems to concern the sports.
Well, sports and books. Let me introduce you to Eric Andres.
I was on my knee waiting for Brooms Up, and I was thinking, okay, been practicing a couple months, throwing a qualifying round. This is my first match of intercollegiate Quidditch, and this is the craziest thing. And I'll never forget that moment because it was the start of something great that I'm still involved in after college.
So do I understand why this guy's talking about actually playing Quidditch?
He did. Eric Andres is the founder and captain of the Emerald City Admirals Quidditch team. He's even ref 2 World Cups in Florida and South Carolina.
So just to be clear, Quidditch is a made-up game in the make-believe world of J.K. Rowling's fictional books, right?
Correct. It's the game played by high school and professional wizards in the Harry Potter books. Sort of similar to the way football is played in real life, but Eric Andres plays Quidditch in real life every week here in Seattle. He's been playing for 5 years now, and he told me it all started back in 2010.
A friend I was working with at the radio station in college said, "Did you know that they play Quidditch in real life?" No, that sounds stupid, but awesome. And she said, "Yeah, we should get some people together and play Quidditch here at NAU." And okay. So we got a little informational meeting, posted a couple flyers, told friends to come, and we had probably 20 people show up in the lobby of a residence hall. The official team at NAU, anyway, needed some leadership, and I was happy to step into that role. And I basically coached, built, and captained the team through my first semester of senior year. And we grew from 6 people playing in the snow, you know, on a Sunday afternoon for half an hour with dollar store brooms to a 60-player program with, you know, equipment and sponsorships and school support and travel plans. So,
what year was this when you formed and pretty much organized and led and coached this new thing at Northern Arizona University?
This was 2010, and I remember that because the night we got club status at NAU, I was standing in the very, very long line for the premiere of Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1.
Can you walk me through some of the rules of Quidditch? Give me like a brief overview of how the Quidditch that's played in real life is different than the Quidditch in the book.
Sure, yeah. I'm glad you said brief because brevity is not the name of the rule book. The rule book is, I think we're on rule book 9. It's about 160 pages. There's a lot of loopholes you have to close when you're creating a sport based on the writing of somebody who hates sports. J.K. Rowling's, you know, I don't care about sports, and she's just sort of made up Quidditch to make fun of the sporting world. We went a step further and let's actually play it. So everybody has to ride a broom. That's rule number 1. You have to stay mounted to your broom. You have 3 chasers on each team, like the books. You have 2 beaters on each team, a keeper and a seeker. Now the snitch is chased by the seekers, just like in the books. And the snitch is attached to the snitch runner. Snitch runner is effectively an extra referee that actively interacts with the players. So the best snitches I've seen have long arms, wrestling, jujitsu, sort of martial arts background.
So Ripley, I'm going to stop you here. This is Gabriel again. What does any of this actually mean? I think I heard quaffles and snitches, and maybe a beater?
Well, it's pretty complicated, really. But it's basically dodgeball and basketball and broomsticks.
I think I'm with you. Okay, back to you, Eric.
Is it ever dangerous to be running around with a pole between your legs?
It always is, yes. But what I tell people is broom injuries count for probably 5% or less of the injuries in Quidditch.
Do you know at all if all of them have read the books?
I don't know. If all of them have read the books, that's usually not a question I ask anymore. Other than that, I'd say at least half of our team, maybe all of the team, has seen the movies, and half of them have read the books. That's a guess. But it's not something that's really important to us in the long run. It's important for getting people to understand what we're doing and getting people to understand why we're passionate about what we're doing. A knowledge of the books, the knowledge of the movies, isn't necessary or a prerequisite to enjoying Quidditch.
What are you doing?
Playing Quidditch. And for me, Quidditch and Harry Potter are very different things now. I'm a very big Harry Potter fan. I've read the books dozens of times. I used to profess that I have a PhD in Harry Potter. But the way Quidditch has grown and the way I've grown with Quidditch, I see it as such a wonderful community and sport that helps me stay active and be competitive because I'm a competitive person and stay in touch with people from around the country and around the world. I've met so many people and traveled so much because of this sport, something that Harry Potter, the books, didn't do for me, like Quidditch did.
How does being involved on this team matter to you?
Being a Seattle transplant means you don't know a whole lot of people here. Moving from Arizona without any sort of base here in Seattle was hard, and it has been hard, but the reason Quidditch is so important to me now is that I've always found good friends in it, good community, good home base of people that I really like, and building that team in Seattle is going to help me with that.
How do you deal with the haters, with the people that drive by and say, you know, like, oh, you're not even flying or something?
I deal with that in a variety of ways because they're driving by and they're going to keep driving by. We're not going to see them again. So there's no point. But when people come up to us and they're like, what are you guys doing? Oh, we're playing Quidditch. like from the Harry Potter books? Yeah, but like, look, it's pretty cool. You want to play with us? Nah, man, that's stupid. A lot of us have grown a thick skin. When people bring questions or snide remarks, mostly our response is to educate them, because once they learn about what we're doing, how can you not understand how important it is to us, and how can you not understand that it's an athletic sport and something that brings us together?
Do you feel like a symbiotic connection to your teammates, or is there an I in team?
Being part of a greater whole of a team, of a community, of a league, of, you know, the sport itself, I'm happy to be the ambassador of the sport. I'm happy to spread the good word, you know, about Quidditch. And that's something I've always held dear, yes.
Why did you decide to bring something fictional to real life?
Goes back to Harry Potter and Joe Rowling's writing was, you know, maybe not as poetic as E. E. Cummings or Hemingway, but she has such overarching themes and interweaving storylines that she purposely and very knowledgeably puts together for great benefit of the readers. And the product of that is a wonderful connection to the books, and you feel really connected to Quidditch. You feel really connected to Harry, you feel really connected to Hagrid, you know, many different characters in the books. And when you get an opportunity to sort of live that out, because neither of us got our letter, you know, you jump at it. And I got into Quidditch for Harry Potter, but I stayed because of the community and the athleticism and the competition. Trust your team and hang out with them, because those are some of the coolest people you never thought you would get to know. People from all walks of life come and play Quidditch, and you rally under this really great sport. And you meet a lot of people that you wouldn't normally go out of your way to meet, and you're much better off because of it.
That story from sound effect intern Bree Ripley. Ripley, thanks for being on our team.
It's good to be on the team.
It's Sound Effect from KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. We are thinking today about stories of teamwork. And so far, we've been talking about the sports. And it's pretty obvious how teamwork comes into play in baseball or even in dog racing. You got a dog team, after all. But one less obvious place where teamwork is just as crucial is in a restaurant. And if you've ever worked in food service like I have, you know that restaurants, at their best anyway, tend to be well-oiled machines. You've got servers and line cooks and bussers and barbackers. Everyone has got a part to play. And there is one very old team of this sort in Seattle that is about to be broken up. Mama's Mexican Kitchen in the Belltown neighborhood is going to be closing next spring after more than 40 years in business. So for us, who work just a few blocks away, this means farewell to some of our favorite enchiladas, to the Elvis Room, and of course, we're going to be mourning the loss of this neighborhood establishment. But for Bella Biagio and the rest of the people who work there, it means even more. Bella has worked for nearly 20 years there on and off, and she jokes that when Mama's closes, she's going to put an ad in the paper looking for new work.
Mama's is closing. Bella needs a job. She needs to be able to say, f**k.
So for Bella, Mama's just makes sense. They get each other. Sure, all restaurants require teamwork, that dance between the servers and the cooks and the hosts. But for Bella, she says the team at Mama's is different, more like family. She spoke to KPLU's Ed Ronco.
I am Bella Biagio. I work at Mama's Mexican Kitchen, and I've worked there approximately 18 years as a server. I took a year or two away, always came back, tried to work at other places, and I always would get in there and go, oh, my God, what am I doing here?
What are some of those places?
I worked for a Tom Douglas restaurant.
So fine dining kind of thing?
Yes.
How'd it go?
Not well, because I moved to Philly for a year. I was in fine dining, and one of the laws in the book was, literally written in the book, do not touch the customer and don't touch the table. Well, they just couldn't control me. So I was constantly touching people and had my hands all over the place. They just were like, oh my God, you're not good at this at all.
What's your name?
Bella.
Bella.
Yeah.
Bella, couple questions.
Yes.
Screamer enchiladas. What is a screamer? What does that mean?
It is a enchilada with sour cream on it.
Oh, screamer. Gotcha. Okay.
It is the island of Misfit Toys. And we are that island, totally that island. We are the train with the square wheels and the gun that shoots jelly and the Charlie in the box. I mean, it's totally that. And it's so dysfunctional, but it works. It's really efficient. We just know.
Can you do me a huge favor? I'm going to put in a big salad. Can you put a big salad up? Thanks.
I am constantly entertained by the human race. I mean, I think I get more angry now, but that could be because I'm older and I've been there longer.
Yeah.
And I have no tolerance.
Yeah.
You know, I'm telling people no more now than, like I say, there's more no's than yeses in the world now.
You're not going to fawn over the customer.
There's no fawning.
This is Mama's Mexican Kitchen.
See? Fast.
On a scale of 1 to 10 from not busy to super busy, where are we?
Well, right now I'm pretty busy.
Yeah.
But I'm not in the weeds, as they say.
Middle front six round table wants 2 fried jalapenos.
I might be in the weeds now.
How did you hear that Mama's is closing?
It happened, I think, a month ago, maybe. Yeah. Maybe. And then they said, you know, developers bought it and they're leveling the building. I just assumed that it would happen eventually, that's all. I mean, it's been there for 41 years. He's 65 and he's ready to, you know, do something different. And I assume that, and I never even questioned it.
Does it matter in the grand scheme of Seattle that Mama's is closing?
I believe it does. And I think that we're another one that has eaten it.
Why does it matter?
There aren't places that are, like, to me, genuine. Mama's is a genuine place that you'll never find again. There are a lot of duplicates of a lot of things. Everything's very clean and tidy now. Mama's is not. You will not find that again. There's no more dirty. There's no more, like, raw. And I always thought, maybe I should just open a place called Ch-hole because there aren't any.
People would know exactly what they're going to get.
Yeah. And everybody knows what you're going to get at Mama's. And that is just, it is a heartfelt situation for me and for, I think, Seattle.
You know, you mentioned the island of misfit toys.
Yes.
So is this the sinking of the island? Are all the islanders going to end up somewhere else? Are you going to be orphans?
Well, you know, in the story of the island of misfit toys, Santa came back and picked them all up and took them to their appropriate places where they would be loved. So I'm hoping that occurs, you know, for all of us. I mean, all of us will have to find a different island of misfit toys, I guess. And hopefully that will happen for all of us. But it's really odd to me that we don't talk about it. Like, what's next?
That at work you don't talk about it?
No, not really.
Even the not talking about it seems very family-like to me.
Yeah, right? Right? That's how I grew up.
Yeah.
We didn't talk about it. That's exactly right.
It's just kind of, well, it's going to happen, and you know, when Grandpa goes, we'll figure it out, but...
That's exactly right.
That piece from KPLU's Ed Ronco. You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're talking teamwork. So, as you know, we have had a hot summer in Washington State. And the funny thing about Washington is that, you know, we're happy to complain about the rain for 9-10 months of the year. And then when the sun comes out, oh, it's too hot. All right, the Yiddish inflection may just be me. But one thing is clear. Here in the Pacific Northwest, very few of us have air conditioners. And so then when we have one of these prolonged heat waves, the stores all sell out, and then the profiteers on Craigslist jack up the price. But this year, viral videos have come to the rescue. You've probably seen one in this genre. People using pretty standard household items to build a homemade air conditioner. Now, these things tend to be a little harder than they look, but the way to tackle this kind of project is definitely through teamwork. So Sound Effects Senior Producer Kevin Kniestad is joining me now in the studio. Hey, Kevin.
Hello, Gabriel.
So you recently teamed up with another KPLU luminary to see if you guys could put one of these things together. Who is your partner exactly?
That would be Midday Jazz host Dick Stein.
Whose idea was this?
Well, this was actually the idea of our executive producer, Aaron Hennessy.
Well, I certainly don't have the patience to do something like this. And then I remembered Kevin and Stein teaming up during the pledge drives. They talk about how the KPLU grocery tote bag could fly and morph into things like toasters and tanning beds, fix a transmission in my car, and then it hit me. If they can team up and convince me that a tote bag can do all of that, then they probably can make a homemade air conditioner out of a fan and an old cooler.
All right, Gabe, so I'm the farthest thing from a handyman, and I actually had no idea if Stein is a handyman at all. Most people know him for this.
Hi-ho, Jazzoids. Dick Stein here, behind the big red switch.
But, you know, Aaron's the boss, so we decided to give it a shot.
Hey, you don't look like the Avon lady.
I'm most certainly not the Avon lady. Hey, Richard.
Hey, how you doing, Kevin?
Good, good. You know, it doesn't strike me as public radio hosts being all that handy. Are you an actual handyman?
I'm actually pretty handy. I do a lot of stuff around here. And, you know, my wife, the lovely and talented Cheryl DeGroote, likes to call me Mr. Fix-It. I'm not quite sure if she's being sarcastic or not. It's hard to tell with DeGroote. But this is a cool deal, and we can do it. I've got all the tools.
So the video that Aaron showed us was basically a cooler turned into an air conditioner.
Yeah, it's really a simple concept. It's very clever. It's just one of those little ice chest coolers, plastic ones. You cut two big holes in the top, one that you insert a little fan into, and one that you put in a piece of angled PVC piping. Put a chunk of ice down inside the cooler, cover it, turn it on, and the fan is blowing air across the ice. It's got nowhere to go but out the PVC pipe, and it's blowing cold air out.
All right, this doesn't sound too complicated. It's a pretty simple project.
Right. But part of teamwork is preparation and coordination. And so we needed a few more things from the hardware store. But Gabriel, right off the bat, there was a little bit of a hiccup. I forgot my wallet.
Oh, really?
Convenient, Kevin.
Yeah, I also might have neglected to pick up the ice on the way there as well. So with Stein's credit card, we headed to the hardware store to find ourselves a fan.
Do you have anything bigger than this? Just slightly bigger?
One. Right there. 6-inch.
You want to get the big one, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, man, you want the big one? Let's get the big one.
Yeah.
And then to the grocery store to get some ice.
Oh, they do have blocks.
A block. What do you think? That would fit.
Well, that's more than going to fit. I think what we should do is get a block.
And then we were all set to go. We got back home, and it was time to get started. And there was just one minor detail that we had to figure out first. By the way, who's doing what here? Who's in charge of this little operation?
Well, are you used to operating power tools, Kevin?
No.
Yeah, maybe I better operate the tools.
Okay. And Gabe, for the record, I can totally operate power tools. I swear, I just was respecting my elder there.
I would have totally done the same thing.
Have you ever made anything that you've tried to create some sort of air conditioner thing before? Anything like this at all?
No, never. The only thing I ever did was like 30 years ago when I had a TV that, you know, there was no, you know, remote for it. And I rigged up this thing with an old lawn sprinkler and pulleys. And it ran through all these different pulleys to a connection on the volume with a clothespin on it. And I couldn't stand to listen to commercials. And I didn't want to get up, and I didn't have a remote. So I would just rotate the lawn sprinkler, and it would pull the monofilament, and it would actually turn the thing off and on. I would cackle like a madman every time I did it. So until now, that's the last thing that I did along these lines.
Okay.
All right. Here we go. Whoa. Cut right through. That's where the jigsaw blade is going to go, and we will now... Whoa! Get in.
Now, you got to cut the first hole. You're going to let me try and cut the second
hole?
Sure,
you want to cut the second hole?
Yeah, I'll give it a try.
Okay. Well right. done, well done, Kevin.
That?
Hey, let's see how the PVC fits in there.
Okay, so hold on a second, Gabe. I'm going to spare you a little bit here because there was another 20 minutes after we tried to fit the PVC pipe in there, of it not fitting and having to kind of, with the jigsaw, shave a little bit more of that hole.
I'm kind of enjoying this, though.
And it turns out that the hole we cut for the fan was too big. So for both of the PVC pipe and for the fan, we brought out that hardcore duct tape to hold the fan and the pipe into place on the top of the cooler.
Would you say this was aesthetically pleasing?
Well, we were going for cold air, Gabriel. We weren't looking for it to enhance the balance of the yin and yang in Stein's kitchen.
So. Okay, fine. Fair enough. So, okay, now that you've got this fan duct taped in one hole to the lid of the cooler and this big kind of angled PVC pipe duct taped into the other hole, what did you do next?
Well, it was time to make it cold. So let's go with the block ice in there first.
Oh, yeah, you were right. We could have got a couple of these. And now we'll just pour in the crushed ice. And now for the finishing touch. This is called flash tape. It's supposed to keep birds, you know, from nesting in the eaves of your roof. So,
streamers.
Yeah, little streamers. Right. Yeah, will that be fun?
I guess we close it up and plug it in. It's showtime.
Showtime. Stand by.
Ready?
Activating ambient atmosphere impeller. Impeller activating. Look, it's making the streamers go, man. Does it feel cold?
Oh, yeah, it feels cold. But that's on, you know, you've got it on low.
Okay, increasing impeller velocity.
The streamers are flying. I think we did it.
Oh, that is definitely, that's some cold air, man. Don't believe it. You know, the only thing is it doesn't really blow it very far. You gotta put your face right up against it.
Well, you wanted to get that little tiny fan.
Yeah, you're right. You were right. I admit it, you were right. We always get the big one. Okay.
What lessons did we learn?
I don't think we learned anything that we didn't already know. That we're infinitely resourceful, and once given the idea, we can take it and run with it, man.
Yeah.
I've got some frozen mugs.
Okay, all right.
Okay, well done, bud.
Well done to teamwork. Cheers. You know, this house is cooler already.
Well, nicely done, Kevin. Would you say you guys are proud of your work?
We are proud of our work. It's kind of ugly, but it's our ugly air conditioner.
KPLU's Dick Stein and sound effect producer Kevin Kniestad teaming up on this project. You can find pictures of their homemade air conditioner and a link to a video showing you how to make your own at our website, kplusoundeffect.org. Sound Effect comes your way thanks to some extraordinary teamwork. Senior producer Arwen Nix and producer Kevin Kniestad keep us in the game week after week with help from producer Matthew Stribe. We also had contributions this week from Ed Ronco and intern Bree Ripley. We had web help from Mike Lewis, and our team captain is executive producer Aaron Hennessy. You know we're on iTunes, right? You can subscribe to our podcast there, and please consider writing us a review. It really helps. You can also send feedback to soundeffect@kplu.org or tweet at KPLU and at Gabriel Spitzer. Let's do the same thing again next week, shall we? We're going to be asking ourselves, doesn't it feel like we've done this before?
And I'm not like one of those like quiet gays either. I'm like one of those like, you know, I'm gay, you know.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.